Many pilots who had survived this far into the battle had probably also endured the horror of being hit in mid-air by bullets or cannon shells, and of having to bail out of a plane travelling at several hundred miles an hour, an experience remembered in different ways.
It happened all very quickly, as you can imagine, when a chap collides with you in mid-air. And so I just stood on the seat and the wind blew me out. I was doing 250 miles an hour, so the wind was 250 miles an hour, and it's a fair old hurricane. But going down, you never seemed to move. You were hung in mid-air. You were stationary between heaven and hell. In fact, I was just about over East Grinstead, and the whole town was watching me because they had nothing better to do because it was a Sunday and the pubs weren't open yet. And I finished up, up at the end of a tree. I was met by a posse of home guard with pitchforks, and one of them had a shotgun pointed at my head. I managed to scramble down the tree and fell with a resounding thump from about 10 feet. And the old man said, "Donner and Blitzen," to me. And I said, "Shove off, you stupid old you-know-what." And he said, "God, this one's an Englishman, isn't he?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm English."
There's all these things which we had in the book saying, invert the aeroplane, you know, undo your straps, undo your oxygen, undo your radio, and then slide the hood back and invert the aircraft, falling out. You never have time to do that. You just one panic, ripping off of the straps which are holding you into the aircraft, back with the hood and out as fast as you can. There was one time I just pulled a pin out of the straps and the aeroplane bunted over and I was thrown straight out.
And suddenly the cockpit was filled with bullets and something hit me in the leg. And it didn't feel like a bullet, it just felt like a tap. And my lateral controls went. And the three Spitfires pulled up alongside and looked at me and half rolled away. I didn't see them again either. I've often wondered whether it was they who shot me. And anyhow, then I saw blood coming out of my flying boot. It's a weird thing, once you see blood coming out like that, you start to think, oh, Lord, I'm going to get lightheaded, you know. Anyhow, I bailed out. I opened my canopy and I pushed the stick forward and out I went like a bullet from a gun. And I delayed my drop down to about 4,000 feet till I hit the cloud base, which I knew was 4,000 because we'd come up through it. And I was wearing a German May West, which I got off some chap. And I saw people gathering underneath me. I was coming down over open farmland. And I thought to myself, ho, ho, because there had been stories. You see, the British public took it quite for granted that any airman coming down in those days by parachute was a German. And there'd been occasions of RAF pilots being beaten up by the locals who were convinced they were Germans, wouldn't believe it. And I was wearing a German May West. And I saw these chaps underneath the odd pitchfork. And I was a bit worried about it all. But in fact, it was all right because they'd seen my airplane come down. So they all said hooray.
Richard Hillary memorably described his own experience when, during a sortie, he was surprised by an enemy fighter.
At that moment, I felt a terrific explosion which knocked the control stick from my hand, and the whole machine quivered like a stricken animal. In a second, the cockpit was a mass of flame. I reached up to open the hood. It wouldn't move. I tore off my straps and managed to force it back. But this took time, and when I dropped back into the seat and reached for the stick in an effort to turn the plane onto its back, the heat was so intense that I could feel myself going. I remember thinking, so this is it, and putting both my hands up to my eyes. Then I passed out. I regained consciousness free of the machine and falling rapidly. I pulled the ripcord of my parachute and checked my descent with a jerk. Looking down, I saw that my left trouser leg was burnt off, that I was going to fall into the sea, and that the English coast was deplorably far away. About 20 feet above the water, I attempted to undo my parachute, failed, and flopped into the sea with it billowing around me. The water was not unwarm, and I was pleasantly surprised to find that my life jacket kept me afloat. I looked at my watch. It was not there. Then, for the first time, I noticed how burnt my hands were. Down to the wrist, the skin was dead white and hung in shreds. I felt faintly sick from the smell of burnt flesh. By closing one eye, I could see my lips jutting out like Michelin tires, while the side of my parachute harness was particularly painful, so that I guessed my right hip was burnt. I made a further attempt to undo the harness, but owing to the pain in my hands, soon desisted. Instead, I lay back and reviewed my position.
Hillary came down in the channel and was eventually picked up. When James Nicholson won his VC, he too had been forced to bail out. On his parachute descent, he had been ignominiously shot in the buttocks by a keen home guarder, one of the rare ones with a firearm. He had neglected to mention this in his radio talk. But still, the greatest fear for pilots was being caught in a burning aircraft, and many of those forced to bail out, like Richard Hillary, suffered appalling injuries from blazing fuel. Most of them were eventually referred to a pioneering plastic surgical unit at the Queen Victoria Hospital in East Grinstead. Here, in Ward 3, Sir Archibald Mackinder performed groundbreaking reconstructive surgery on burns victims, whose hands and faces in particular were horribly disfigured. These young men formed themselves into the Guinea Pig Club with their own theme song.
We are Mackinder's army, we are his guinea pigs.
We are Mackinder's army, we are his guinea pigs. With the bows and sails, the flags of England wave. And when we get our nations, we'll shout them all alive.
The last line of the song, Per Ardua Ad Astra, We'd Rather Drink Than Fight, was very much the authentic tone of the club. Mackinder himself was an inspirational figure, running an unorthodox but highly successful medical service. Geoffrey Page remembered.
After a day of strenuous surgery, he would come into the ward, grab one or two of us, and we would retire to one of the local pubs. We would drink beer and Archie would indulge in his favourite drink of gin and tonic. It was only many years later that I learned that he had all the barmen tipped off and that instead of permitting any gin to be placed in his glass, he would merely drink straight tonic, which perhaps accounted for the reason why he lasted out the evening so well. Another aspect of Archie's unofficial rehabilitation program on us was that he would brief the local residents to invite us into their homes. After a short while, with their kindness and understanding, we would find ourselves free of, shall I say, inhibitions as regards to our facial and bodily injuries, and we were accepting a normal type of life again.
And Paul Hart.
I was badly burned. Most of my face had gone, and with it the will to live. He gave me back the will to live. A great deal has been written about Ward 3. There was so much freedom, but no one ever seemed to overstep the mark. And it was the rule, rather than the exception, to have a case of beer under the bed. And it was not unknown for an operation to be put off from Wednesday to Saturday, for the simple reason that the whole ward had been invited to a party on Thursday night. Unorthodox? Of course it was unorthodox. But this was Archie Mackinder and nothing was impossible. We all felt safe. If the boss was going to do it, it would be all right. To the guinea pigs, he was a kind of father confessor. He always had time for all of us, and indeed our families too.